Good afternoon. This is Michael Osterlink, and I'm speaking with Richard Hodapp, chairman of the Mapping Alliance. Richard was with the team launching the Xerox Education Group. He is also participating as a member of the G8 Commission on Globalization, specializing in affecting government policy decisions regarding the environment, defense, sovereignty, and security. He is a member of the State of the World Forum and has been a fellow of the European Center for Public Affairs. Richard is the author of You Can Do Miracles, a guide particularly designed for children to understand the mysteries of the dying process, and Procession, a recently published story of the hero's journey and life's transitions. Good afternoon, Richard.
Good afternoon.
And how are you doing today?
Fine. It's a joyful day. I'm visiting my family, and my son lives at Lake Tahoe, so I'm sitting here looking out at the lake and the snow-covered mountains. It's just splendid.
Richard, you're doing a lot now. You've done a lot in the past. And more recently, in the past, I think, 20 years or so, you've created something called the Mapping Alliance, which is a company that promotes something called a mapping process. And before we get into the Mapping Alliance and the work that you do in terms of decision-making, mapping decision-making, can you tell us how you got to the position of creating this way of thinking about how decisions are taking and affecting decisions?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I was hired out of college to be part of a team to launch the education group at Xerox, and so we were marketing training programs, and I noticed that no one was giving management and strategy training to salespeople. I thought that would be a good idea. I proposed it to the management at Xerox. They didn't like the idea. So I left the company and started my own business, and that was 40 years ago.
Wow.
And had the pleasure of going back and interviewing some of the top founders in American industry who were very clear on their thought process. And what I thought I was doing was creating a map of how they create strategy, but it turned out to be a map of how their customers make decisions that intuitively they understand and tune into what is the decision process and what are the decisions that will have to be made for the right agreements to come about. So it really is the decision mapping process. We trademarked it in 1978 as a term, and it's taken me all over the world through GE and Procter & Gamble, even to places like the UN and the Pentagon. We're working with the European Union now. These are all organizations whose success is largely based on the external decisions they're able to bring about or to effect. And so that's what this is all about. It's not thinking so much about internal. So when someone says, think outside the box, this is way outside the box. This is over there, getting into the minds and thinking of the customer and understanding what decisions need to be made, and really understanding the process by which decisions get made. That was not my objective when we started. I thought it was going to be a strategy map. Like, what do we do to create a great strategy? Turns out, a great strategy is decision-focused.
How did you know how to ask the right questions that led you to change from strategy to decision on the other side, not even decisions within the company that you're consulting with, decisions that they're trying to affect on the outside of their own internal processes?
I had a great mentor. I started the business in Cleveland, met a 94-year-old guy named George Herzog. George started the first commercial banks in America, and he was kind enough, I just introduced myself one day, and he was kind enough to share his thinking. One of his principles was keep it simple, and he introduced me to some of his compatriots who were real business leaders in America, people like Cyrus Eaton and George Herzog. And keeping it simple said, how did you win the contract to provide the financing for the Alaska pipeline? Can you tell me that story? And so it was simple questions like, what happened next? What happened next? What happened next? And after doing these case histories for various clients, I started to see a pattern that just repeated over and over. And so I thought I was capturing two things. One was the elements that go into decision making, and there are about 50 elements. So to say that we do that all this intuitively, it's kind of a naive statement. We may do 20% intuitively, but it's nice to have that map of all of those elements. And the other thing I saw were the patterns. That's probably the advantage I have because my brain sees patterns. And then I could go back to these people and I say, is this what you did? Was this what happened? I said, I think we have a map of what you did. And these business leaders came back to me and they said, well, I think you have a map of how our customer makes decisions, which is even more powerful. So now, like teams from the UN can use this in Africa to introduce new policies to the 58 countries of the African Union and know the kinds of decisions they will need to affect to help get these policies adopted. Same with the European Union. Their struggle is not writing great policy, but getting those policies adopted. In a way, their product is the policy that they're trying to advocate. So I work with more traditional companies too, whether it's Procter & Gamble or a famous pharmaceutical company in Europe, or a company that makes the new artificial grass for soccer fields. I mean, I never know where I'm going to wind up working, what part of the world or what kind of industry. It's almost always referral. You know, someone who has worked at GE goes to another company and calls me and says, you know, I thought everyone thought this way because it had become such a common way of thinking, mapping decisions, talking about the process and the decision we have to affect. But now I'm at this other company, nobody thinks this way. You got to come down here. So that's how I get new business. It's really from not exactly referral, where one person introduces me to another, but it's where one person leaves an organization, goes to another, and feels this wonderfully desperate need to call me and say, you got to come to Australia and introduce mapping in Australia. And I go, you buy me the ticket, I'm there.
I've heard you mentioned some large corporations,
yep,
governments, and international organizations. I would imagine listening to you talk about the process you take these disparate organizations and businesses through, that it must be content neutral, because I can't imagine, as smart as you are, that you're a content expert on all, you know, within all these different realms of human activity, from industry to sod grass to defense issues to Africa policy.
It's a great term, content neutral. I sometimes refer to myself as being content free. Which,
okay,
to a technology organization, tells them I don't know anything, but I know the process, and that's what they need to know. And most of the organizations I work with, their content is so technical, and they are so invested in their technical content that they have a pretty strong reputation as being content arrogant or technically arrogant, and they really rely on that technical content. So any improvement in the process of engaging in and affecting decisions with customers gives them a real competitive advantage.
I can see that. Now, in your process of asking these questions of these very successful gentlemen that you mentioned earlier, as well as kind of mapping this whole process out, are you discovering, or have you discovered, universal codes?
I think there's a, when you set aside the cultural differences, you know, I honor the cultural differences and the standards and the various principles that you encounter as you go around the world. But underlying all of that, there is a common process. These elements are core. So when I'm, for instance, in China giving a mapping conference, usually for an American company doing business in China. So it might be Lockheed Martin, or it might be Procter & Gamble. But when I'm there, I always get asked out into the hallway by one of the elders of the Chinese organization, who asks me, where did I get this process? because we in China consider this decision process, how decisions are made in China, we consider this secret. Where did you get it? And I want to say from all these old guys in Cleveland, but
that's pretty good.
They say, well, in our tradition, we go through this process, and you are not invited to the into the process until the end. And here you have a map of the whole process, so you can decide when to engage and how to affect our decision. And I always add, with you. I mean, there's no better relationship than making decisions with your major customer. And I've worked with a lot of small organizations, too, that have grown and grown and grown. But, you know, someone has a brilliant technology idea, and they hear about mapping. And so we run a small conference, 5 or 6 people, and decide what are the decisions that will have to be made out there in the market for this product to actually get launched and adopted and integrated. And those are the decisions that will then drive their growth.
You actually just stole my question, because I was going to ask you, take me through a process, and maybe you could go a little bit deeper. Assume for the moment that I'm a new client, and I called you and I said, Richard, I sell whatever. You can make it up, whatever is of interest to you today. What can you do for me? And you kind of touched upon it already, but talk me through what you would tell a potential new client in terms of what you would offer them in terms of the mapping process and how effective it would be. And what's actually involved? Is it a day? Is it 2 days? Is it 50 minutes? A month? How does this whole thing work?
Well, every meeting, every first meeting seems to follow a pattern, which is that we have to distinguish, as you and I have this afternoon, distinguish between their technical content and the process by which their customers make decisions. So what I'm bringing them is an improved knowledge, an enabling technology, and an enabling process technology to understand that customer decision process. And it really is like advanced management, advanced strategy training, which happens to be focused on customer decisions. So when they see that there can be an improvement made to process to give them that kind of advantage, then they need to know that I'll be providing two things. One is a map of that process, and the other is a vocabulary that articulates the process in simple ways, but in profound ways, like understanding not only the decision that needs to be made, but the scope of that decision and who has a role and what that process really is. And then you can decide what are the resources that you need to use to engage in and affect those decisions. Now, it's pretty easy to say, I think I do that. I think that's simple. Well, I articulate it pretty well because I've been practicing for 40 years. But the fact is, it takes about 3 days to really learn it. And the best way to learn it is to come to a conference having selected some examples that you want to use, so you're there not only to learn decision mapping, you're there probably as a team, and you are mapping real strategies to affect current and important decisions.
So you said it's 3 days. Who in an organization or a company would be invited to the 3-day process?
It's wonderful when the leadership of a company invites people to participate because of the kinds of challenges they're being given. So right now I'm working with a company in Europe. It's part of what we would call Danone Yogurt, but it's actually Danone, and it's their medical products group. And the CEO of that group, with his head of marketing strategy and business development, have identified their key markets, the people responsible for growth in those key markets. So they are inviting those people to nominate what needs to be mapped and who should be on the team. And then we're running a series of 5-team conferences. So there'll be about 30 people in each conference. And we're running those conferences all over the world. So, and interestingly, the CEO and his team attend every conference. So that's somewhat unusual. Although, you know, when we worked with McDonnell Douglas, John McDonnell and Sandy McDonnell participated in winning space station contracts. So a lot of times it is a vertical mix of people, and it's a horizontal functional mix of people on the team. And they have spent some time, most often with our guidance, to select the kinds of things that should be mapped. And ideally, the things that should be mapped are the kinds of opportunities that they want to win because they're terribly important or because there are many of those opportunities, and that's going to become the lion's share of their business growth.
This is Michael Osterlink, and I've been talking with Richard Hodapp. He is the chairman of the Mapping Alliance. Richard, I know that during your conferences, your three-day conferences, one of your teaching tools is storytelling, and you're a fun, entertaining, and amazing storyteller. And I'm wondering if I can put you on the spot and ask you to retell the story of the energy crisis, Canada and Mexico. Do you know what story I'm referring to?
Oh, yes. I'll be happy to tell you. And sometimes an individual approaches me at the airport and says, you know, I will never forget that story. And I will say, which one? And it's the one you're talking it goes back a long way. It was in the 70s. I was traveling with AT&T, had decided to use decision mapping to enable them to consolidate the 28 operating Bell telephone companies into one cohesive marketing organization. And I was traveling with one of their training people. We were in the St. Louis airport. And it was every decade energy crisis. I think it was 1976. And people were worried about the price of oil going beyond $50 a barrel. And so I was saying to Bob, hey, Bob, what are you going to do about the energy crisis? And he said, well, we're going to buy a wood stove. It's actually an add-on to our furnace, but we have a lot of trees on the property. I can cut the trees, split the wood. And, you know, even when the price of oil goes up, I will have that wood furnace to help heat the house. And we talked about wood stoves and what kind of wood stove he wanted to get and how hard that might be. And then I was walking up to, I was in the Admiral's Club at the airport. I walked up to the coffee machine, and there was a gentleman there, and I introduced myself. I said, I'm Richard Hodapp. What brings you to St. Louis? And he mentioned he had an important meeting with August Bush, the chairman of Anheuser-Busch. I said, well, that's very interesting. I'm Richard Hodapp. And he said, I'm John DuPont. And I said, Mr. DuPont, do you have anything to do with the DuPont company? And he said, well, I'm the chairman of the Nemours Family Foundation, and, of course, we own the DuPont company. And I said, I'm doing consulting for the Elastomer Chemicals Group there. And he wanted me to go away. And he said, well, good for you, Richard, which was kind of a signal to leave me alone. And I wanted to keep the conversation going. And I said, Mr. DuPont, what are you going to do about the energy crisis? And he said, merge with Canada and attack Mexico. And my brain is tuned to wood stoves. And I'm thinking, he didn't say anything about wood stove, did he, Richard? No, he didn't. And I started to think of, there's a part of the map missing. And there was. At that time, there were seven elements. And he was introducing a new element to me, which we wound up naming scope. I mean, buying a wood stove is one scope. Buying the energy resources of North America, different scope. Same question,
right.
Different scope. And I said, are you serious? And he said, yes, I'm talking to one of the dominant families in Canada, and we feel with the right relationships in the financial world, we can gain a position of ownership for the energy resources of North America. And with that, we can challenge the development of Pemex and oil and gas potential from Mexico. And so the way I look at that is Bobby bought a wood stove, and DuPont bought Conoco, Spindletop, tar sand. I mean, they bought the energy resources of North America.
Right,
and it
right.
was, and what's hard about that for some people is they don't know whether they're selling wood stoves or a financial strategy to consolidate the energy resources of North America. And it's really important to get clear on not only the decision you need to affect, but the scope of that decision. And in mapping, we spend some time on realizing what is the scope of the decision the customer would have to make in order to actually make this decision. And an example of that is Lockheed Martin selling F-16s to Israel. Until Netanyahu decided to modernize the Air Force in Israel, he was not going to get new airplanes. So no matter how technical, how advanced their aircraft might be, the scope of the decision that they had to make in Israel was to modernize their defense forces. Well, if you're selling an F-16, there are only a few people in your organization that can think that way. And so you need those people on your team to affect that kind of decision. And they did. And that all came from John DuPont saying, I'm going to merge with Canada and attack Mexico. How about you, Richard? What are you going to do about the energy crisis?
Well, I love the story, and I actually asked it because I was very interested in you getting into the scope and showing, you know, explaining the different levels of scope, you know, from one wood stove to taking over all the energy industries of the continent, basically.
I have to say, I think it's a major issue for the United States and our global competitiveness because we've been trained and conditioned to think of ourselves as problem solvers. And that is one scope, but it's a much lower scope. And it's important. We have to be able to solve the problem, meet the customer need. There's nothing wrong with that. But if the customers out there in the world are trying to change their strategy or adopt new principles or even a philosophical change, then we need to be able to scope up and engage in decisions of that scope and successfully manage those. And we're not very good at that. And so I always find that, particularly for companies that have international markets, that this question of knowing the scope of the decision we must affect in order for both organizations to thrive, it's a critical question. And
it actually is a critical question. And I think our foreign policy, in terms of the United States foreign policy, is an example of the failure of thinking in those lines of thought that you just talked about in terms of efficiency.
We're out there pushing our solutions, and when the other government is saying we're not looking for solutions, we're looking for strategy, we just start telling them how good our solution is again and again. And so even though we're talking about politically trained people who know protocol, they all too often are thinking at that lower scope when their customer is suggesting they would really like to make a bigger scope decision with us. And so we need to learn how to scope up. And in fact, the rest of the mapping process talks about how you do that. But being clear on what the decision is that would have to be taken, I just shifted it into international. Internationally, they take decisions. They don't make decisions. So if I say, well, who is going to be making this decision in Europe? They go, don't know that word. So I find it is a relevant process regardless of scope, whether I'm mapping something that is a decision that needs to be taken at the White House or in a laboratory or in a military service or a commercial, fast-moving consumer goods company or somebody that wants to build a new soccer stadium and is thinking about whether they should have artificial turf or not. These are all parts of the same world, and they all have a common process. It's fascinating to see that no one's thinking about those elements of the decision map. They're thinking about what is our product and how well does it fit the need, or what is our product and how much or how well does it solve the customer's problem? So all too often, everyone thinks they should go find people with problems that need solving. And mapping says, well, that's one scope, but there are six others.
We're interested in learning more about mapping and talking to you about bringing you on board to do one of your three-day conferences. How do they find out more about the Mapping Alliance and how they contact you?
Well, there's a website, decisionmapping.com.
Okay.
And on the client comments page, there is a videotape that was created as a gift from the leadership of the European Union. And it's people at the European Union talking about decision mapping during a conference I was giving in Brussels. And younger people, older people, top of the European Union, from the cabinet all the way down to new hires, are all in the same room. And they say everything that I could ever want to say about the process, and they're speaking from the heart. And just drop me a letter from that website, or you can write to me at mapping@EOS.net, and it's Richard Hodapp. I'd love to hear from you.
Great. Well, thank you, Richard. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Amazing process. I've been fortunate enough to witness it a few times, and I encourage anyone and everyone to check out your website. Watch the video, and whether you work for an organization, a corporation, a government, or an international body, please consider contacting Richard Hodapp and bring him on board to help map out decisions. Richard, have a great time out there on the West Coast. Enjoy
Thank
your family.
Thank you, Mike. It was a pleasure to speak with you. Look forward to seeing you next time in Washington.